We are going to open to Numbers chapter 13 today. We know that we're probably right around the third, maybe the fourth month of the second year of the Exodus. We're only a few weeks from departing from Mount Sinai, and we've already had a whole bunch of deaths because of sin. And it's just going to get worse. This is not a spoiler alert, this is a history alert. The generation that came out of Egypt had spent 430 years kind of being formulated with compromises into pagan ideology, pagan thinking, sinful attitudes. And it's just really hard to kind of get rid of that. And the story we're about to tell illustrates how bad it is. It also explains why they did not get to celebrate the second anniversary of the Exodus from Egypt in the Promised Land like they should have been. Because we're actually on schedule with what we're looking at right here. They could have been in Israel and had a blessing and cursing ceremony at Mount Gerizim and Mount Ebal up by Shechem in the seventh month of the second year of the Exodus from Egypt. And then after that, they could have all started planting crops in whatever plot of ground they had been given by Moses and the leadership, the 70 leaders of Israel. That's how it could have gone. But instead, it's going to be a total of 40 years. And here's how that happened. Numbers chapter 13. He who is spoke to Moses, saying, "Send men to spy out the land of Canaan, which I'm giving to the people of Israel." Now, the word spy out, I don't know about you, but I have kind of a negative connotation that I put with it. The word basically just means look around. Tour is the Hebrew word, which I always find fascinating because that's kind of what you do when you're checking things out in a country. You tour the country. So send men to tour out the land of Canaan is what it actually says, which I'm giving to the people of Israel. From each tribe of their fathers, you shall send a man, everyone a chief among them. So God wants a representative of all 12 tribes. Now, the Levi tribe is going to be excused, because their inheritance is going to be scattered throughout all of the other 12 tribes' inheritance. And so they don't need somebody to represent them in this process of surveying land. Verse 3, so Moses sent them from the wilderness of Paran according to the command of he who is, all them men who were heads of the people of Israel. The wilderness of Paran, we'll find out later, this is Kadesh. We also call it Kadesh Barnea. I disagree, as I've already said, with the modern-day consensus of Kadesh Barnea being between the valley that connects the Dead Sea and the Gulf of Aqaba and the Mediterranean coast. It's in that area out there in the wilderness, the Negev, that their traditional Kadesh Barnea is placed. I don't believe that makes good sense. I think it makes much more sense that Kadesh Barnea would be on a major traveled road north and south. And so I believe it's probably about midway up this valley, this flat area that connects the Gulf of Aqaba on the south with the South Bay of the Dead Sea on the north. And I also believe it's kind of on the the west side of that flat plain, at the mouth of a wadi, a drainage area. And so that would be right on the border of South Canaan. And that is the direction from which they were originally going to enter the Promised Land. About 60 miles north from that location I just described is Hebron, the Cave of Machpelah, the place where the patriarchs of all of these people are buried, the matriarchs, Abraham and Sarah, and Isaac and Rebekah, and Jacob and Leah. I think that Hebron would have been one of the first places that they'd want to go to once they arrive in the Promised Land. Just throwing that out there as my opinion. Now, who was in this group? These were their names. Now, the names won't make much a big deal to most of us, but there are some key names on here I want to highlight. So we've got from the tribe of Reuben, Shemua, the son of Zakur. From the tribe of Simeon, Shaphat, the son of Hori. From the tribe of Judah, we have Caleb, the son of Jephunneh. So Caleb is one of the good guys. He's the hero of this story, one of two. He's in his mid-40s. We know that at this time. From the tribe of Issachar, we have Igal, the son of Joseph. From the tribe of Ephraim, Hoshea, the son of Nun. Now, this is Joshua. His circumcision name was Hoshea, which means by itself salvation. But as it tells us at the end of the section here, when he becomes the aide-de-camp, the lieutenant of Moses, Moses gives him a new name component at the front of his name. He puts a shortened form of God's divine name, Yahweh. The shortened form is just simply Yah. And so his new name becomes Yahoshua, he who is salvation. And I love it. He's the other big hero in this section. Then from the tribe of Benjamin, Palti, the son of Raphu. Tribe of Zebulun, Gadiel, the son of Sodi. From the tribe of Joseph, that's from the tribe of Manasseh, remember, because they both have full tribal status because of what their dad, Joseph, did by giving up his inheritance in favor of his two sons. Gadi, the son of Shushi. And of the tribe of Dan, Amiel, the son of Gamali. From the tribe of Asher, Satur, the son of Michael, and from the tribe of Naphtali, Nabi, the son of Vophshi, from the tribe of Gad, Guel, the son of Malki. These were the names of the men whom Moses sent to spy out the land, and Moses called Hoshea, the son of Nun, Yahoshua, Joshua. And so those are the 12 guys. Moses sent them to spy out the land of Canaan, and he said to them, go up into the Negev and go up into the hill country and see what the land is. Now, the Negev is the northern part of the Sinai Desert. So they're encamped at the wilderness of Paran, and north of them is the Negev, the southern desert region of Canaan. So that's the first place they're going to go through. And then they're going to go into the hill country. The hill country is the ridge of higher land that starts a little bit south of Hebron, and it kind of goes straight north from there, and then it takes a little left quarter turn and heads out to Mount Carmel and meets at the sea, at the little bump that you'll see on the maps of Israel there on the coast. That's the hill country, the central highlands of it. So go up to those places in particular, see whether the people who dwell in it are strong or are they weak, whether they're few or many. So these are the things that they're going to be marking down, probably taking notes, to give us a report. Who seems to be more militarily prepared? Which ones are like really small places? Which ones have lots of people living in it? Whether the land that they dwell in is good or bad. So what's good for a particular type of agriculture? What wouldn't be good there? That sort of stuff. Whether the cities that they dwell in are camps, which are much more temporary, not very well protected, or strongholds. Those are more permanent places, more than likely having walls. And whether the land is rich or poor, and whether there are trees in it or not. Trees are very important. Now, there's not trees everywhere in the Promised Land. It's got grasslands. It's got kind of wilderness areas where it's a little bit on the dry side, but it's still good for grazing. So they need to know all of that. Be of good courage and bring some of the fruit of the land. So that's the last thing he tells them. When you're on your way back, and he's going to assign them 40 days to get this job done. When you're on your way to the back, get us some examples of the ripened produce of the land. And when they come back, they're going to bring grapes with them because it was the time of the season for the first ripe grapes. Now, we know that's in July, and that's one of the reasons why I say that we're probably talking about them starting around the fourth month of the Jewish year, and they'll come back in the fifth month. That's my guess. So, verse 21. They went up, and they spied out the land. They took a tour of it from the wilderness of Zin. That's actually where they're at. That's another name for Paran area. Zin has to do with a flatness. And so that's probably a reference to the flatness there in that long connecting valley between the Gulf of Aqaba on the south and the Dead Sea on the north. So go from the wilderness of Zin to Rehob near Lebo Hamat. Now that's clear up in the north. So he's basically saying from the extreme south where we're at, I want you to go all the way to the extreme north of the Promised Land. Now, Lebo means entrance. Hamat was the name of a city way up north of the Promised Land, almost to the bend in the Euphrates River. But there's a long valley. It's called, oh my goodness, suddenly it just went out of my head. The Bekaa Valley, which is between the Lebanon Mountains and the Anti-Lebanon Mountains, so the opposite of the Lebanons, and this long north-south valley has an entrance point there close to the foothills of Mount Hermon. And Lebo Hamat, the little gateway to that long valley toward Hamat, is going to be the extreme north of the Promised Land. So that's why they want to go all the way there. For our purposes, it's basically like a day and a half walk north of the Sea of Galilee, something in that neighborhood. So they went up into the Negev, the southern desert. They came to Hebron. Remember, I told you that would be one of the first places they had intended to occupy once they came into the Promised Land, and it's actually the first big community as you enter into the hill country. And that's where they find Ahiman, Sheshai, and Talmai, the descendants of Anak. Now, Anak is one of the subgroups of the gigantes, the giants, the Rephaim, the Anakim. These are the product, I believe, of the fallen angels once again monkeying around with the human genome and apparently hoping they won't get busted like they did the last time they did this before the flood. But they do have the presence of these gigantes, which that's the Greek word where we get giants from, and it literally means born of the earth. And so it's really not so much a talk about how big they are, although they do tend to be big. It's more the fact that they are a product on earth of these demonic forces, these fallen angelic forces, trying to insert their control over human affairs. All right, so we know there's going to be giants right around Hebron. Good old Caleb will pay particular attention to that because he likes the area right around Hebron. It looks good. I think he also likes the idea of being near the cave of the patriarchs and the matriarchs. But he volunteers to take that territory for his inheritance, and he will take out the giants. That's what he'll tell us. Then they came to the valley of Eshcol, and they cut down from there a branch with a single cluster of grapes. Remember, it's grape harvest time during their trip. And they carried it on a pole between two of them. This is an image that you will see from time to time. Even though the Israelis of the more New Testament era did not believe in representing human forms or animal forms, they would represent agricultural forms. And so some of the coinage, some of the wall decorations, the mosaics on the floors would have this huge cluster of grapes hanging from a pole that would have been between the shoulders of two men. So that's one monstrous cluster of grapes. Interestingly enough, when Herod the Great volunteered to renovate the Temple of Zerubbabel, one of the design elements that he had his engineers include was a giant hanging cluster of grapes. I think it was in bronze, although I suppose it might have been in gold. I'll have to go back and reread it. But it was in some sort of metal, and it was on the front of the temple tower. You know, the temple had a great big tower at the front of it, about 180 feet tall is what the design of Herod called for. And on the front of that, hanging there amidst all of these other vines and things that were designed and decorated, was this cluster as tall as a man. That's the way it's described. And so that all comes from this story, how marvelous the produce of the country was. And they also brought some pomegranates and some figs. Now, I like eating my figs when I go to Israel. Pomegranates, I just never can get into pomegranates. Maybe I'll try them again this time that I go. But these are all things they love to eat as summer fruit. And so they bring these things back as examples of what is being produced. That place was called the Valley of Eshcol because of the cluster that the people of Israel cut down from there. Eshcol means cluster in Hebrew. And so that's how it gets its Israeli name, because that's where they got this representative giant cluster of grapes. And so they bring this all back. Verse 25, at the end of 40 days, probably assigned by God, certainly by Moses as the time element that they had, they returned from touring around the land, spying out the land. They came to Moses and Aaron, to all the congregation of the people of Israel in the wilderness of Paran at Kadesh. There we go. That's how we know it. They brought back word to them and to all the congregation and showed them the fruit of the land. So look at this. And in my mind's eye, I picture Joshua and Caleb hanging, bringing the fruit with them, that they're the ones carrying the pole that this is coming from. We don't know that, but that's how I'd do it if I were doing a fictional representation of this. And they told him, We came to the land to which you sent us. It flows with milk and honey. So just like they'd been told by God. And this is its fruit. However, the people who dwell in the land are strong. Remember, they were supposed to check that out. The cities are fortified, so they have walls. They're very large, so they've got some pretty decent populations. Now, remember, this is way back in time where there were less people in the world than are alive in North America, or excuse me, in the United States right now. So we're talking about big cities of probably 5,000-10,000 people. And besides, we saw the descendants of Anak there, those gigantes, those giants. The Amalekites dwell in the land of the Negeb. They've already had a run-in with the Amalekites. Joshua beat them with God's assistance. They're the troublemaking Canaanites living in the south, exactly where it's described here. The Hittites, the sons of Heth, who had a civilization to the north of Canaan at one time, but now a lot of them have kind of migrated down here. The Hittites, the Jebusites, that's the people living, the Canaanites living at the old city of Salem. They call it Jebus. We will eventually call it Jerusalem. And then the Amorites, another flavor of Canaanite, dwell in the hill country. They're all over the place. And the Canaanites dwell by the sea and along the Jordan. So there are Canaanites of different types, plus some non-Canaanites, living all over the place. Verse 30, but Caleb quieted the people before Moses, because the people are like, they're starting to panic, have that panic attack, and said, let's go up at once and occupy it, for we are well able to overcome it. So he's like, I don't care what you all are talking about here. It's the promised land that God promised to us. Let's go. We can take it. Verse 31, then the men who had gone up with him said, we're not able to go up against the people. They're stronger than we are. And so they brought to the people of Israel a bad report of the land that they had spied out, saying, the land through which we have gone to spy it out is a land that devours its inhabitants. Now, it's not altogether certain what that idiom seems to mean or where it came from, but it's certainly negative. We know that. It's a place that'll chew us up and spit us out, perhaps, is our equivalent. And all the people we saw in it are of great height. That's a reference to the giants. Apparently, their genome material has been spreading through here, and so the people living in Canaan right now are, on average, taller than what the Israelis are. Then we saw the Nephilim. Remember the fallen ones? That's the literal meaning. The sons of Anak, who come from the Nephilim. And we seemed ourselves like grasshoppers, and so we seemed to them. So we're little things compared to the Nephilim, the Anakim, that are living there in that country. One little interesting tidbit, just throwing it out there for some fun, okay? When we talk about giants in our European background, we think about the fee-fi-fo-fum, I smell the blood of an Englishman, and then all about this idea of giants eating people. Well, interestingly enough, that is a very widespread belief in lots of different cultures throughout the ancient times that these gigantes, these giants, ate people. Just like we, if we were Israelis, would eat locusts or grasshoppers, you know, roasted on a stick. And so it's possible that not just simply size is being referenced here, but on the menu. So just throw that there for you to kind of wonder about in how dangerous these giants were that needed to be gotten out of there. Couple minutes left. Let's set up for the next part of the story. Chapter 14. Then all the congregation raised a loud cry, and the people wept that night. So they've heard this report, and everybody's crying. Why? Because they've come all this way, these last 18 months or so, and there's no way they're going to get in and take the promised land. All the people of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron, because it's their fault, you know. The whole congregation said to them, "Oh, would that we had died in the land of Egypt, or would that we died in this wilderness. Why is he who is bringing us into this land to fall by the sword? So why are we going to die in war? Our wives and our little ones will become a prey. Would not it be better for us to go back to Egypt?" And they said to one another, "Let us choose a leader and go back to Egypt." This is their desire, to turn around, tuck their tails between their legs, go back to Egypt, I suppose apologize to the Pharaoh, apologize to all the taskmasters, apologize to all of the Egyptian people that they spoiled, took their silver and gold and precious stones and clothing, and apologize for all the damage to the economy that was carried out by the plagues, and apologize for the death of the firstborn, and basically say, "Can we go back to what it used to be like?" This is insane, folks. And they want to reject God's leadership of Moses and Aaron and go back into slavery. Such a spiritual lesson to be learned here. When we have been freed from sin by Jesus Christ, there is no way in the world we should want to go back into the sins of this fallen world.